The Story of Rubber. One day, in 1852, in Trenton, New Jersey, two lawyers appeared in the Circuit Court of the United States. These two men were the legal giants of their day. They were there to argue the case of Goodyear versus Day for infringement of patent. This was the patent for turning raw rubber into vulcanized rubber, which led to its widespread commercial success. Daniel Webster was the lawyer who represented Charles Goodyear, and Rufus Choate represented Horace Day. Goodyear and Day were in dispute as to who was the inventor of the process which put rubber into the service of the world. I'll return to this court case later in this episode. But first, I must tell you about the other party important to this historical case. That other party is the rubber plant itself. Or rather, rubber gum plants, which may be trees or vines, that produce the raw gum which can be converted into the substance we call rubber. These rubber gum plants grow in areas of North America, South America, Africa, and other places. Many believe, though, that the best wild rubber was sourced from trees near the mouth of the Amazon River in Brazil. The methods for acquiring raw rubber gum in Brazil didn't really change much for 500 years. The natives used canoes on watercourses to reach the trees deep in the jungle. They cut V-shaped or spiral incisions in the trunks of 60-foot trees. At the base of the incisions, they affixed small clay cups, like swallows' nests. They would return later with large gourds to collect the fluid from the clay cups. The filled gourds were brought to their village, where they then built their smoky fires of oily palm nuts. Dipping their paddles into the fluid gum, they would turn and harden it, one coating at a time, in the thick smoke. When the desired thickness had been attained, the hardened rubber was cut from the paddle with a wet knife. So what did these early pioneers of rubber do with it? Well, in 1493, Christopher Columbus was about to find out on his return trip to the Caribbean. The Caribbean was another place that natives harvested and cured the gum from rubber trees. Christopher Columbus and many of his men were visiting a section of Hispaniola, or modern-day Haiti, for a second time. His men had brought wind balls from Europe to play with in the idle hours. These wind balls were usually made from an animal bladder and wrapped in leather. They were called wind balls because they were inflated with air. However, the men found the local balls of Haiti bounced much better than their wind balls. These high-bouncing balls were made by the natives from a milky fluid which was obtained by tapping certain trees. Similar to methods in Brazil, the milky fluid was then cured over the smoke of palm nuts to harden. Any discovery which improved ball games was quite noteworthy. A Spanish historian transcribed all that the governors of Haiti reported about the bouncing balls. Some 50 years later, another Spanish historian related that the natives of the Amazon Valley made shoes of this gum Spanish soldiers soon learned to spread this gum on their cloaks to keep out the rain. Many years later, in 1736, a French astronomer in Peru brought home samples of the gum. He reported that the natives have various uses for it, including shoes, bottles, and bright lights which burn without a wick. This tree gum was also found helpful for another use, erasing pencil marks. The tree gum would rub out the pencil marks, so was often called rubber. Shipmasters brought native shoes made from rubber to their home ports. The shoes were thick, clumsily shaped, and heavy, but they sold. There was a demand for more. In a few years, 500,000 pairs were being imported annually. Around the year 1820, American merchantmen sometimes carried rubber as ballast on the home voyage and dumped it on the wharves at Boston. New England manufacturers bid against one another along the wharves for the rubber ballast and used it to make the popular rubber shoes. European vessels had also carried rubber samples, shoes, and bottles home. And experiments with rubber were being done in France and Britain. A Frenchman manufactured suspenders by cutting a native rubber bottle into fine threads and running them through a narrow cloth web. Charles McIntosh, a Scottish chemist, created a raincoat by combining fabric with rubber that had been dissolved in a coal tar naphtha solution. McIntosh called his new raincoat a McIntosh, of course, and began selling it successfully in 1824. These McIntosh raincoats have continued to sell well to this day. The company who sold them even changed their name to McIntosh in 2003 and opened their first fashion store in London in 2011. But let's get back to the early days of rubber. At first, the new business in rubber yielded profits. The cost of the raw rubber material was very low, and there was a high demand for rubber products. In Roxbury, Massachusetts, a firm created waterproof leather by treating leather rubber, turpentine, and lampblack. Initially, the process appeared to be a complete success. Large capital was invested to make waterproof leather shoes and clothing out of this new product. Merchants throughout the country placed orders for these goods, which, as it happened, were made and shipped in the winter. But when summer came, the huge profits of the manufacturers melted away, literally. That was just a tasty nibble of my newest bonus episode. You can peek in the episode notes to learn more about it. If you are a Silk Plus member, then you'll find the full-length version of this bonus episode waiting for you in the bonus podcast. If you're not a Silk Plus member, then you can easily become one by using the link in the episode notes or by going to silkpodcasts.com. You are now just a small hop away from accessing this bonus episode and over 400 additional episodes, all free for a limited time. That there are a lot of episodes to feed your restless brain squirrels. Nom nom, nom nom nom.